Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Caligaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute, and most importantly, the host for today's episode. And today, I am extremely excited to introduce Diana Dybel, design leader, co-author of The Conversations with Things, and Chief Design Officer at Grand Studio. Welcome to Design Chats, Diana.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, we're super excited. And I think we've got lots of great topics to dig in today. I think some of the work that you're doing is super interesting. But to start, just to kind of give our audience context a little bit about you, tell us a little bit about your journey to design. What first sparked your passion for design and where has it led you?
Sure. So I actually went to school for playwriting and I didn't know that design was a thing. I didn't know it was a thing that I could do. And through a lot of twists and turns, I wound up at a health tech company where I was writing interactive patient education. So things that would come sort of like videos over the internet, and then you have a little bit of a choose your own adventure to move through it. And through that job, I discovered sort of inadvertently design and had a wonderful time and really great teachers both around me as people and just opportunities and experience to learn from it, and wound up learning a ton of qualitative user research and conversation design at that job. And that really just sparked my interest to see how it could impact people in a really meaningful way as healthcare. So like literally life and death situations and how to treat things responsibly because you are dealing with these high stakes. And so I think like that was for me, the eye-opening, wow, I could really do some awesome problem solving, and the skills that I have of observing people and talking to people actually translate over to something in the business world.
Well, and I think it's a great sort of jump in to see where you can have impact, right? Because like you said, these are high kind of stakes conversations in really important areas, and you can see just how much impact you can have on that. And I think for a lot of designers, that's why they do what they do, because they can make a difference and they want to.
Yeah, for sure.
So before we get into what you talk, what kind of your focus on today, talk a little bit to me about what is conversation design?
Yeah, that's a that's a great question. So the way that I typically explain it to like my mom or people at parties is it's basically the work that somebody does to teach something like an Alexa or a Siri how to talk to you and how to understand you. So really what we're doing as conversation designers is a whole horde of things, but it involves some research. It involves writing like a lot of dialogue. It involves listening to people and observing people to understand how people speak, the cadence in which they speak, the words that they use, and then programming the system and working with engineers to create logic paths that make sense for the patterns in the way people speak.
Oh, that's good work right there. I think we've all seen our machines and our phones get a lot better at this, and it's really frustrating. We have pretty high expectations too. So it's really frustrating when something doesn't communicate with you the way you expect it to, or where it doesn't understand you when you speak.
Absolutely. I think honestly, that's the hardest part of the job, is that the technology's gotten better, which is awesome. You can do so much more, but also now the expectations are higher. So if you are not doing it carefully and thoughtfully, then people really notice. And the tolerance for mistakes is really low because we've all been speaking and being in conversations since we were very, very small. Mm. So to us, it feels so natural. Like, why wouldn't you understand that I just said, no, wait, yeah. Where like in a human, you totally understand what somebody meant by that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So thank you for that, because I find that fascinating and I wanted to dig in. But so talk a little bit about the work you do today at the firm you're at.
Yes. So Grand Studio is a digital product design and strategy company. We also do a ton of service design as well. And what we really get asked to do the most is to do ambiguous problems for really large companies. So I am under NDA, I can't name names, but for example, a global sports organization came to us and asked us to figure out how to serve their international customers who also watch the game. And how might we do that in a way that doesn't allow for spoilers when we know that like the media is covering things and sharing things, but still allows people to be really active and engaged in the game. So those are the kinds of questions that we get asked to solve. And that could be anything, right? Mm. Like that could be looking at solving global media outlets and how do you sort of tamp down the news that comes out. It could be looking at actual digital experiences, which is where we wound up going and serving things on everything from the phone to webs to things like the Roku player and Apple TV and what those experiences can be like so that people can really be part of the game, even if they're not physically at the game, which turned out to be really helpful when we hit 2020.
Yes, it was. That was good planning. You know, I think what's so interesting about the work you do is the ambiguity. And I think in some ways it's like the purest form of design, right? There is no solution in mind at start. It's just exploration. But it can also be really hard when there aren't sort of bumpers in place, right?
Totally.
It's just like wide open. So like, how do you go from like wide open to, hey, let's start to kind of circle in on where we might want to go?
Yeah. So I think a really good example of this one is we worked with a really large healthcare institution in the US, and they had grown a ton by acquisition. Mm. And in general, if you have more than one hospital that you is under your umbrella, you have more than one way of doing something. Like hospitals naturally just become their own entity and do things their own way because they need to serve their community, which makes sense. Now, if you add in acquisition on top of that, then you really have just like a bunch of different ways that the people are doing things. And they wanted to streamline operations a bit so that if you walked into this hospital in Illinois and then you went to the same one in Texas, that you would get a similar experience. Mm. So to start with that, they wanted us to just take a look at surgical scheduling and how do we fix that? Like, okay, well, that's a wide open playing field.
That's obtuse. Yes.
So we did some conversation with them to get to that like surgical scheduling piece. So at least we had some amount of like narrowed scope. And then they said they wanted to have something that they could build themselves. So this was a build, not buy sort of scenario. So we knew those two things going in. And then from there, we just said, okay, we need to get on the ground and see what's going on and figure out what are the actual problems that need to get solved, not just what are the business stakeholders saying that needs to get solved. So we talked to them, of course. We talked to the business stakeholders because they are an important part of the process. And then we also talked to surgical schedulers. We talked to surgeons. We talked to OR nurses and all kinds, anybody that had a hand in from the patient getting diagnosed all the way to them going back home after the surgery to get a sense of what does that process look like? Where are the pain points? Who are they pain points for? And create this service map of problems that are happening, technologies that are getting used, people that are involved, all that stuff, so that we could really take a look at what are the moments that matter? Where are the key points that if we solve these, they will have an impact and they will have a bigger impact. So in creating that was super helpful. We were able to talk through with our stakeholders, like these are the problems that we're seeing. And then we brought some really light concepts, like just sketches to that meeting to talk through. Here are some ideas that we think we could implement in these major moments that feel like they could help solve this problem. Let's talk about it. And in those conversations, we were able to have a little bit more like a grounding to the problem and a grounding to where this could go, which helped the stakeholders who had never been involved in a design process before. They're clinicians. They're used to running the hospital, and that's important. And honestly, they don't need to be super into design in order to do that. So having those sketches really helped ground them, and having the moments pulled out that would have the most impact really helped ground them. And they were able to prioritize along with us which concepts made the most sense, which problems made the most sense to go after. And we were able to have a conversation in sharing some of the research with them about how we might need to change this concept so that it works for the business as well as for what we had seen on the ground. And from there, we were able to actually translate that into, okay, now we have a design brief. Now we can actually go build the thing.
I would think when the problems are sort of so broad, so ambiguous, as you call them, it's really, really important to bring the stakeholders along, because otherwise the jump from here's the problem to here's a specific solution would feel so big to them. And also to your point, because you're dealing not with designers, right? You're dealing with hospital staff and surgeons and operations people. And so giving them the check marks or the checkpoints along the way, I would think would be really critical.
Yeah. And I think some stakeholders are more open and willing to being actively involved in the process.
Mm, true.
I think, like, specifically in this instance, they're literally saving lives. Like, they could not be bothered, and fair enough. Like that,
they were doing some other important stuff. All right, that's fair.
Exactly. So we really had to make use, and like, this happens all over the place. This isn't just, you know, a healthcare problem.
Yep.
And I think when you're in those instances, it becomes really tough, because you want to have, or at least I do, I want to have stakeholders there with me in the research. I want them to view and hear directly from people. So if I can't have them in those sessions, if I can't have workshops with them, then those meetings and those touch points that we have become super critical to really hone the story that we're telling and relate it to their specific problems and the things that matter to them, to bring them along and say, okay, these are the things we heard and how it relates back to the thing that you've asked us to do. And here are the things that you may not know about, but are going to impact that thing that you asked us to do. And it may feel like these other things are like out on a tangent and that they feel very far from the thing that you're focused on, but here's the way in which they impact. So trying to really connect dots for people so that they can get on board, even if they are not able to physically be present in some of these research moments.
You know, and I think it's a great point and a great piece of advice for everyone in design, no matter what company they're at or who their stakeholders are, right? Because we like to play in the research, right? You know, we would love it if everybody came along all the time, but it's also about understanding what the stakeholder wants, trying to find the right rhythms for them and the right way to bring them along. And to do that, like to your point, you could see in this area that they had very busy schedules, but it's their schedules, it's their desire, it's their understanding, it's their focus. All of that is used to help us determine what is the right timing and what is the right way to bring along the stakeholders.
Yeah. And I would say, like, if you have any ability to record in any way, like photos of the problems you're seeing or video of somebody talking or audio of somebody talking, if you can't share their face because of whatever consent forms that you have, or even quotes, if you just want to like take it and put it on a slide. I think the audio clips for me feel like the right happy medium, where we're not showing somebody's face where they could be identified, but also you hear the emotion in the person's voice. And that can really sell something and really help bring people along, even if they couldn't be there in that moment.
And I think that's great advice too, because I think another thing we do sometimes is we take all of this information, all this research we have, right? And our job is sort of to assimilate it down. And when we see the sort of summary of it, we have all that emotional background, right? That little sentence summary brings up in our mind all of the interviews we heard, all of the research we did. When we're translating that to a stakeholder or a partner, though, it doesn't come naturally to them, right? They see just the sentence, which feels so impactful to us because we have all of it behind it. But combining that summary with some of those emotional and sort of human-centric and based pieces is, I think, what, you know, means they didn't have to go through the whole process, but they can share in the importance and the understanding of sort of the synopsis and the end research that you share out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can talk about how all the kind of bringing the stakeholders along and sort of exploring the space through research. Like, there's so much there. What other challenges do you get? Or, I mean, it's kind of fun too, right? But how many challenges when you have an ambiguous project and you're trying to figure out how to start and refine, what other pieces come up?
So I think the second like biggest thing that may not be as obvious, but certainly as consultants we deal with all the time, is there's this organizational piece and almost political piece that exists behind the scenes. There's always somebody who is funding the project and they have a very specific ask or idea in mind. But then there are other stakeholders that also have ties to this in some way, particularly the bigger and broader and more ambiguous it is, because it can touch so many different groups. And as you start to do the research work, you start to figure out like, okay, well, this is actually going to impact this department over here and this department over here, and we need to get them involved. And then they may come in and say, wait, who greenlit this project? We're working on something else that's going to, you know, combat what you all are doing. Or I don't know who you are. We have our own in-house group that does this. Why are you here? There are any number of things that can happen that make people feel antagonistic to the work that's happening. And so I think the biggest part of the upfront and sort of getting everybody to the design brief is also navigating these internal politics and figuring out, okay, we know there's one group of people that we need to bring along. Maybe even we know there's two groups of people we need to bring along. But what about all these sort of invisible people that are going to come into the process? Let's try to identify them and let's try to have meetings with them so it doesn't feel like we're springing things on them and taking over work that they're having. Or if we are taking over work, because that does happen sometimes, how can we fold in our joint work so that it doesn't feel like some sort of war that's happening between the group we're representing and the group that's doing the other work?
Again, I think something that probably many people on the call can relate to, right? You have the very obvious stakeholders and your partners in there. And sometimes there's just the unintentional frictions that you call elsewhere. And one question I think I would have for you then is how do you help suss out what those are, right? Because they're not necessarily, in your case, the person who engaged with your company. How do you help see the other stakeholders that you want to be able to touch?
So we usually try to do some amount of stakeholder mapping, just kind of really mining through with the people that we're working with. Okay, who else, as we're exploring this work, if we go in this route, what are the possibilities that this could touch? Or when we start to see that they're coming up, who are the people that are in this group that we can connect with? And just trying to like keep that mapped out so we're keeping track of everybody. And then once we identify those people, it's trying to set up meetings with them, whether it's a stakeholder interview or it's bring them into a review or just connecting with them to find out, hey, what's important to you? What are you working on right now? We don't want to step on your toes. And just kind of being a nice person. Being thoughtful about other people. And I think that can be really tough to do as designers because we're taught so much to think about the end user that we almost put on this antagonistic view of anybody who would harm the end user. And I think it's just as important to have empathy for all of the different stakeholders, because first of all, they're going to impact the end user's experience. So you need to get them on board to make that happen. But also, like, we are all people. We are all human, and it's important to treat everybody as such so that, you know, you're being a good person. Like at the end of the day, like I think everybody goes into design to try and make things better. And fighting with people all day long is not making things better.
It's not a great fun way to work either, right? I mean, there's like kindness begets kindness, right? Like no one needs to be in the dark spot. So I'm with you on that. You know, you've talked a little bit about the research and the discovery process. At some point, like you said, you're kind of switching to solution, to the wireframes of the options. And this is the one thing, because you guys at your firm do all kinds of design. And I think frequently inside a company, we're like, okay, we make hammers, so let's figure out what the hammer is. Mm-hmm. How do you start to put some, again, bumpers around the solutions? How do you start to refine the, I could solve this with a spaceship or I could solve it with a pencil, right? How do we start to figure out what is the right solution for the organizations you work with?
Yeah. So I think some of that comes into like when we're doing the concepting portion of it, we do kind of run the gamut of, okay, what are the what are the services that could be implemented here that are more like organizational design or service design or some sort of human aspect of this? What are the digital solutions that we could put in place that would solve this? What are conversation design that we could put in place to solve this, et cetera, et cetera? And then just looking at those and saying like, okay, these are solving for this moment. These are solving for this moment. Where are the overlaps? Are there things that we can pull out of this? Because the digital solution covers like three of these moments. Maybe we don't need all of these conversation design moments in here too. Maybe this is sufficient for what the problem is. And then we also look at like, what can the organization support? Hmm. We've been having conversations with them, you know, throughout the period of discovery research. We have sort of like our working group that we typically check in with once or twice a week. They may be on site with us as well and doing research with us and just part of our everyday work. So we never work so far from the client that we're like surprising them with anything. Mm-hmm. And having that those people along in the process really helps us understand what can the organization support. Like, okay, we can support digital, but it's going to take us a year to get there. That helps us know like, great, okay, so we can come up with a digital solution as more of a long-term solution, but what is the mm-hmm. near-term solution that we can put in place to help them now while they are getting to maybe the more optimal solution in a year or two? And so that helps us also kind of pattern out like that North Star versus immediate fix.
Makes a lot of sense, right? Is it solving the problem, but also is it within the competencies of the organization? Because at the end of the day, they're going to have to support the solution and to some extent maintain it, whatever that is, right? It's going to continue to evolve. So it should fit where they have some level of skill set or understanding or expertise.
Yeah. And I think with conversation design, that's actually one of the hardest things is because there will be features that need to get folded in later. And then you have to understand the patterns that you've set up in the system, as well as like the patterns that people are going to want for that specific topic in conversation and the kinds of things they're going to say. So it's like a whole redesigning and programming for every new thing that you add and making sure that it fits with the system in the same way that you would do for screen design. If you were going to add a new feature to an app, it has to lay in with all the other system designs, decisions that you've made up until then. It can't all of a sudden have all these bells and whistles that didn't exist before and sort of wreck the experience that happened previously, because then it feels jarring, and vice versa. It can't just be so plain that it doesn't like live up to the expectation that you've set elsewhere, because then it feels like it's not fully baked.
It feels sort of disingenuous to the process, for sure. So, I mean, one of the things I was curious about is, and I'm sure it varies by client, but like, how long are these engagements? Because when we've worked with consultants and when I've consulted, it's one of those things where like, once someone recognizes they have that problem, like they want to solve it, doesn't matter how long they've had that problem, right? They want to solve it right away. But again, these are big projects. So what kind of time frame are we talking?
It really depends on the client and the project. But generally speaking, the discovery work, so the hospital example that I gave, that discovery phase from like when we started to when the concepts were put in front of the stakeholders for prioritization was 6 weeks. So that was a super fast sprint that we got through. I have another hospital client that we've been working with, and we've done sort of a similar process. And the process from discovery to concepts in front of the stakeholders was more like 5 months. So it really kind of, it depends on the organization and what their needs are, how fast they're willing to move. And a lot of that, how fast they're willing to move, people say that they want things right away, but the organization might not be actually ready to make quick decisions. Mm. That might not be the culture there. They might need to have meetings or other like marketing data pulled into it or things like that, that aren't necessarily going to be in our wheelhouse, but need to get presented in front of the decision makers. So it's a matter of kind of knowing yourself as an organization as to how fast can you move. And some people are better at knowing themselves than others. So we try to just, where we can, suggest what feels reasonable to us, like enough time to get things done right, but in the most concise way possible, because we know the possibility for that extension of time exists in every organization. And sometimes we're pleasantly surprised when people make decisions really fast. That's not always the case.
Is it generally design groups within organizations that bring you in or outside of design?
It's both.
Okay.
So it can be design organizations inside the larger organization that needs support. It could be product or a specific business line that doesn't have a design team or access to a design team. Mm-hmm. We've definitely done a lot of like helping people set up their design teams. So we're the design team and while they are hiring other people, and then we're helping them set up the structure of how does design work within the larger organization so that as they're adding people in, it's becoming more mature and they don't have to set that up after we leave.
Right. And all those new people don't have to necessarily do all of the education exactly. when they come on board, right? There's a place, there's a known spot that they're meant to fill. That can be really hard when you're kind of building the first design team.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. For anybody who's done that, that's
yeah.
What am I doing?
Right. You're like, oh, come on. And I think another thing I was thinking about here, and one of the reasons I asked that question is I think for a lot of designers, right, they see the big gnarly problems that they feel like the organization should solve, that they would like to help solve. But it's sometimes hard to make the space to focus on those sort of big problems because there's so many other problems. There's so many fires. There's so many, you know, other pieces they go. Do you have any advice for those who are trying to be able to kind of fold in some work on the big ones or helping their organization even understand how they might be able to help with something like surgical scheduling, which may not feel like a design problem at first?
The how to solve the big problems when you're putting out fires is really, really tough. Like, we all have a certain amount of bandwidth to do anything. And for sure, you have to like survive. Like, that's step one. And if putting out fires is helping you survive, then like do that. But I think if there's a place in the organization to say, hey, you know, we're spending all of our time, I'm spending all of my time, my team is spending all of our time putting out these fires, and there's a better way that we could do this, but we need to put a pause. Do we have the ability to put a pause? And sort of like asking that up wherever there might be a willing ear to listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I find a little bit more effective is when you ask that question, people are immediately going to be like, oh, well, we can't stop business. Like things are going to fall apart and we can't just stop doing the work. You have to keep doing the work. So coming with a little bit of a plan of like, here's how we reduce the amount of work, not necessarily like stop everything altogether. Here's how we reduce it so that we give ourselves some capacity. Maybe it's just pulling off one designer or two designers to look at like, how do we solve this more broadly? How do we make this so that we're not doing fires, and giving them some time to think about it, where the rest of the team is still putting out the fires and maybe just like reducing the amount of fires that they have to put out, saying to the stakeholders, listen, it's going to take us, I know it takes us normally 2 weeks to address an issue. We're reducing our capacity in order to do this better. So it's going to take us 3 or 4 weeks to address an issue now. And of course, you have to have support from a higher up to make that kind of call. So sometimes that's not possible. If it is, that's to me the best way. If it's not, then I think there are a couple things. And one is, are there things that you can do as a design leader or as a designer where you can make pockets of time to think about it?
Mm.
And I think also thinking about what's your capacity for impact in the organization? Because the reality is that somebody at an entry-level designer might have a really good idea and they might be able to solve a lot of the problems, but they might not be listened to. And that is sort of like the culture at the organization. And if that is the culture at your organization and you're feeling burnt out and like you're not getting the work that you want, then it might not be the right fit for you.
Hmm.
And that's sort of the other option. And that's not a great option. And I know it stinks because nobody wants to like give up on something. But it's also, I think, really important to recognize your own health and capacity and the things that you want out of your work and out of your life, and make sure that the organization that you're at lines up with that.
I think that's really true. One of the other things we talk about, because I don't think all organizations understand the impact potential of design, right? That many organizations wouldn't think, I bet surgical scheduling is a design problem, right? They'd be like, no, it's an operations problem or whatever, you know, kind of problem. So one of the things that we teach and that we talk about is how can you present the work you want to do as it relates to the business outcomes that they mm-hmm. care about? Because sometimes we talk about the design activities we want to do, like the research we want to do, all of which is really true and why it's important, but we don't always translate it back out to the organization and say, like, if we do this, this is, you know, these are the objectives and goals that the business cares about. And I can tie that work that I think is important to how it's going to help move the needle there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like 100% agree with that. And I think there are still organizations that are going to look at that and be like, yeah, no, that's an operations problem. And I think it's frustrating as designers because like we want to be able to impact things. And especially when we know that like, no, if we follow this process, if we attack this in this way, it's going to be better to have people still slam the door in our face. And I think like, that's just sadly part of it.
No, I think that's very true. And there are definitely organizations that aren't ever going to get it. And there are some organizations that'll get it. They're just early on in the curve. And so then it's how can we do some smaller projects and tell the story of that impact so that it unlocks other opportunities, right? There is some education pieces of it, but it's not for the faint of heart necessarily. And it doesn't always successful, but I've definitely seen design teams be able to help bring along organizations and help educate them by kind of demoing the results.
Yes. And I would say that when you're going that approach, doing internal facing work can be a really good one to do it feels lower stakes to the business, but you can still have a high impact and you can still use it to say like, look, we solved this like IT help problem that like everybody in the organization IT help and like poor IT, they're overwhelmed all the time.
Yep.
Like if there is a solution you can build for that and you can show like, this is how the design process impacted it. And it like meaningfully impacts the person you're talking to's life too. Like that can really be a great way to go because there's high impact, low stakes.
That's really smart too, because one of the concerns is always like, if we do that, it will slow down progress, right? But there are a bunch of internal projects that like there's no one working on them. We're not making any progress, right? But that to your point, you could really show the process. And I think in some ways, like your example there, the IT, it's really good too, because it is thinking about, it is a perfect example of using the design process in a way that's for business operations and process in a way that they wouldn't have thought of, right? But that again, you can see the immediate results. So that's a wonderful suggestion.
And the nice thing about internal projects is it's like slow burn it all you want because, mm-hmm. you know, if a fire comes up, great. You can like put out that fire and then go back and sort of work on it in pieces and nobody's really like tracking it because again, it's so low stakes that like, oh, okay, it got pushed back a little bit. That's fine.
But it will be definite high reward. Everyone wants that problem solved, right? All right. We talked about a ton of different things. I think it's fascinating what you do. I love the sort of like, you know, coming in ambiguous situations, learning different business, learning different places. As we've talked about all those different things, what are a couple of pieces of advice or approaches that you think our listeners could take from how you do your work today that they could do internally?
I mean, the first thing that I would say is discovery work makes all the difference. Getting a really clear understanding of what the problem is, who you're solving for, the types of solutions that might be the right way before, kind of to the point you made earlier, Rebecca, of we're a hammer company. What kind of hammer are we going to build for this? Like, I don't know. Maybe this is a wrench kind of problem. And really like being able to identify that saves you so much time and money later on of not having built the wrong thing. And sometimes it's not even obvious that you're building the wrong thing. It's just like, okay, the hammer works, but the wrench would have worked better. So I think like that's the first thing. And then just treating people like humans, not being antagonistic it's so easy to, especially with design and engineering, to get into those headbutting situations. And certainly I've been there. We've all been there. Mm-hmm. But approaching people with an openness and an empathy for their situation, regardless of what position they may be in or what your sort of assumptions about them might be, makes a world of difference in getting through something, at least for yourself, more peacefully, even if they do not change.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's using that empathy that we hone with our users on a regular basis, also for our internal partners and stakeholders. And to your point, does it always work everything better? No. But will your life be better? Yeah. Will you be in a better space? Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the last thing that I would say is just like, I know we've talked about this a bunch throughout this conversation, but really connecting things back to the people that you're talking to, knowing what they care about, and making sure that whatever you are asking of them or sharing with them, that it directly connects to the things that they care about so that they can understand in the way that you understand.
Great advice, Diana. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate you taking the time to lend your expertise and your perspective to Design Chats. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That does it for today's episode. Thank you everyone for listening. And until next time, if you're looking to contribute strategically, drive value, build influence, be sure to explore our training offerings at pragmaticinstitute.com.